Good evening. Can everybody hear me? Am I okay? I'm curious first, how many of you were not here last week? Okay, that's good to know. So as Lynn said, this is the second week of a four-part series on the Four Noble Truths. And I'll just briefly overview the Four Noble Truths, just to review. So the Four Noble Truths are the most fundamental of Buddhist teachings. And the Buddha said that all of his teachings could be contained in the Four Noble Truths. And these are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. He didn't teach these as beliefs or metaphysical statements meant to be just believed, but he taught them as truths meant to be experienced in our lives. It's a very practical teaching. And to that end, he taught four actions associated, an action one with each truth, that we're meant to act on these truths in our lives. So the truth of suffering is meant to be understood. And that's what we talked about last week. The truth of the origin of suffering, the cause of suffering, is meant to be abandoned. And the truth of the cessation of suffering is meant to be realized. And the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering is meant to be cultivated. Today we'll talk about the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering and abandoning it. But before that, I'd like to open it up. I suggested an exercise last week for people to look at their suffering and pick one or two types of suffering. And I'm curious whether anybody tried that or how that went, and if there are also any other questions that might have arisen during the week about what we talked about last week.
Wanting things to be really different than they were, then I was very likely to suffer. But if I could realize that I didn't have to get caught in it, I could just, go through it, then, things weren't wonderful, but I didn't get that nagging, desperate feeling that it had to change.
Thank you.
From our conversation afterward, we decided that maybe I should take a look at boredom. And actually, they may have moved me more to action this past week in that I don't remember being bored.
Did you pick anything else to look at?
I did. One of the aversions I have is to conflict. And I teach at San Francisco State University. And one of the things I was, there was a confrontation in my classroom between two of the students. And there were several unskillful things. And it bothered me. It happened on a Friday, and it bothered me to the next Wednesday. And one of probably my best teachings, I guess, is I called there was two people that it happened between, and then one person left in the room. So I called all three of them into the neighboring classroom and just said that, it was my personal and professional goal to make sure that everyone was honored and felt comfortable in my classroom. And then I felt that we acted unskillfully and that it bothered me over the week. And to talk to them about it and about how I felt about the atmosphere within my classroom, and ask them to rethink their actions and perhaps even apologize. Because the ending of their confrontation was that, I don't want to know you anyway. Mm. And it was rather, and this is a long story, but long and short of it, I asked them to look at each other, you know, that we all come in with different skill sets, and that we consider each other's differences and, you know, perhaps learn from them.
That's lovely.
It was a very surprising action from myself to just confront the whole mess. And I think they were surprised too.
That's really wonderful. Thank you.
Maybe a bigger, you know, lesson from, you know, how I might want to conduct things. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I teach at San Jose State University, and finals started today. And I'm very sensitive to people's feelings, and just a tremendous strain for me, a lot of suffering because of their suffering. So I kind of tried that. And after class, when we were, oh my God, what am I going to do? I have to get 41 points out of 40 on the final, and so on and so forth. I just let myself be with that, and I just kind of breathed into their feeling that it was a remarkable feeling of calm and relaxation. I didn't feel myself absorbing all that energy.
Hmm. Thank you.
I had the opportunity recently to be rated by a group of coworkers, and I got the ratings back, and I hadn't been worried about them at all. But I got it, and I was surprised. I was sort of rated average, and I'm sort of okay with being average, but I'm not okay with them thinking of me as average. And I can sit there and believe I'm completely letting go of that. It doesn't really matter what they think, and in fact, that's a perfectly okay for them. And 15 minutes later, I'm saying, yeah, but it's really not fair to rate people. I've only been their manager for that, you know, 6 months. And I bet that guy's the one who said that, and that's his fault. And then I go back and I try to, it really doesn't matter, and I sort of like, go, but there's a machine that.
Definitely. That machine, that's the one we're looking for. Jim.
The thing I chose was to look at when I read the newspaper every day. Most actually, I read the New York Times on the web. I think only consciously did it a couple of times this week. But in reviewing it, what I realized is that I choose to read the articles that I find most displeasing. You know, it's like, oh my God, Congress is going to this, you know, and then I press the button, you know, I mean, then I click on the button so that I can see more. You know, the other ones that are just, you know, like some sports team won something, you know, I mean, there's no charge there. But in the last couple of days, what I've been realizing is I've been feeling a lot of real sadness. Kind of sadness that this realm is the way it is. You know, that this is how people behave, or, you know, this is the best that we all can do at this time, if one thinks of it in time. And that somehow. Everything is happening. You know, somehow, everything is happening as it's supposed to be happening. But it's also real. It also just there's just a lot of sadness for me in how things are. So that was my experience of the newspaper.
Thank you.
Well, I chose to look at as subtle a level of suffering as I could be aware of, sort of in my daily life, and it took most of the week to really actually be able to pay attention to sort of my foot on the gas pedal and a knot in my stomach or a tightness in my jaw. And just to be aware in an average day when things are going fairly well, sort of the very subtle tensions and then the conditions that cause those and what my part in that is and how much I let my environment influence me.
Did you actually see some of the conditions that caused some of those knots and tightnesses? Or?
Yeah, I mean, rushing because too many things got put in the day. I mean, it seems very simple, but it actually, the suffering seemed bigger when I noticed it. I was like, oh, that's suffering. Yeah, that's suffering. And I've had a practice over the last few months of actually having a much more relaxed pace in my daily life. I've been blessed to be able to just sort of ease up a bit. And I had the opportunity this week to, because I'm getting ready to go away for 2 weeks, to watch acceleration. And some of that's excitement, which is a good thing, but it's still tension in my body. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to interpret it, but it's stress. You know, on some level, it's suffering. And it's not particularly joyful.
Thank you. Okay, we can go on. My time straight here. So the second noble truth is stated as the truth of the cause of suffering. And I think first we should stop and notice that that the second noble truth states that suffering has a cause. It doesn't actually go right out and tell us what the cause is, just right out. So rather than jumping to immediately asking what the cause is, let's stop and pay attention to the simple statement that suffering has a cause. Suffering isn't simply a random event in our lives. And let me stop here for those of you who weren't here last week and just briefly say that the suffering that the Buddha talked about isn't so much physical pain or mental pain. It's actually a reaction to the conditions of our life. That the Buddha defines as suffering. So suffering isn't simply a random event. The Buddha taught that our actions have consequences, and those consequences tend towards certain types of consequences. And this is the Buddha's teaching of karma, and it's a whole talk in itself. I'm not going to go into it. But one thing I do want to say is that the teaching of karma is not a deterministic teaching. It doesn't say that if you do this, this will happen. It's a tendency that if you act in wholesome ways, wholesome things will follow. If you act in unwholesome ways, unwholesome things will follow. So it's not a deterministic teaching that actions have unalterable consequences. But the Buddha taught that we have a choice in our lives, and that choice occurs in the present moment. We can alter the unfolding of our lives through the choices that we make right now. We can alter our suffering through our choices, and I'll talk more about this in a moment. So suffering has a cause, and the Buddha said that cause, in Pali, the word is tanha. Tanha. And that's usually translated as wanting, desire, craving, but the Pali word literally means thirst. And I think that's an interesting word to contemplate because I think it shows us that the kind of wanting that causes suffering is a very, it's like almost a biological thing. When we're thirsty, if we don't drink, the consequences are very urgent. It's a biological imperative to survive. And in a kind of a similar way, the craving that causes suffering has that kind of urgency. It's an urgent feeling that I've got to do this thing or I've got to have this thing in order to be happy. We usually think, when we think of wanting or desire, we usually think about something we want to have. But the wanting, the craving of the cause of suffering also includes aversion, things we don't want to have. So that both strong desire and aversion are considered craving in the Buddhist sense. So the movements of desire, the wanting, and the pushing away, they're rooted in pleasant and unpleasant feelings. In a very simple way, when something pleasant occurs, we like it, and we want it. We want more of it. And when something unpleasant occurs, we don't like it, and we want to get rid of it. It's a very, very simple, very natural expression of living. You can see this in your pets, the way they respond to things, too. Very simple example. When I was a kid, I loved Halloween because I loved candy. And, after my night of trick-or-treating, I would eat candy as long as my mom would let me. And fortunately, she usually stopped me before I got ill. But if she hadn't, I would have kept eating as long as it was pleasant. And at some point, it would have become unpleasant because I was so full and so sick that I would have stopped eating. So our lives are more complicated than Halloween candy, but if we look, we really see that most of our actions, if not all of our actions, are rooted in this wanting, when something is pleasant, moving towards it, when something is unpleasant, moving away from it. It's kind of like an amoeba-like reaction. You just, ooh, that's nice. Ooh, no, thank you. It's very, very bodily almost. And the surprising thing that we begin to observe wanting in our lives is that we begin to see that the wanting itself is the source of the suffering. It's not the object that we want that's the source of our suffering. We're usually so outwardly focused that we get confused about this. So we think, I'm unhappy because my boss didn't compliment me on my presentation today. Or, I'm unhappy because I can't afford a new car. And it's harder to see that the suffering is caused from the wanting the praise or the wanting the car than it is to think of the suffering as being connected to the object itself. But to follow on the candy example with an example of chocolate craving, if we crave a piece of chocolate and we get that chocolate and we eat it, the craving goes away. And then also we get a little hit of pleasant from the chocolate itself. So the wanting itself actually is an unpleasant experience. And we want to get rid of that wanting. And the way we think of getting rid of it is by having. So we want something that's a little bit unpleasant. We want to get rid of it, so we have it. And then we have that thing, and that's a little bit pleasant. So we want more of that. And over and over again, we have this kind of experience where we want something and we get it, and the unpleasantness of the wanting goes away and the pleasantness of having comes. That happens over and over again, and we think, we're conditioned to believe that the only way to end dissatisfaction is to satisfy our desires. So we end up in this round of suffering, wanting, having, relief, pleasant, and then the pleasant disappears a little bit, and then there's, oh, that would be nice to have again. What can I find that might give me that? So there's more wanting and more having and a little relief, a little pleasant, and then, oh, more of that. So we end up on this round of suffering, wanting, having, relief, happy, suffering, wanting, having. So actually the having, another word for that might be clinging in the Buddhist terminology. The having ends up conditioning future wanting and conditions our belief that satisfying our desires is the way to go. So clinging, the having piece, clinging is a very talked about concept in Buddhism. Last week I mentioned that the Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Well, another way he summed up his teaching when somebody said, tell me the Dharma in brief, please just tell me in very brief. And the Buddha said, nothing is worth clinging to as me or mine. So that's another way of putting it. The clinging, the having itself, if you cling to something, the suffering is there. It's sometimes hard to see, but when we cling to something, there's the suffering. The Buddha made a very detailed statement on this round of suffering, and I'm not going to go into it tonight. If any of you are interested, I have in my backpack, I have some more sutta references to hand out if any of you would like to have them. And this round of suffering is described in great detail in some of those sutta references. But in brief, I'll describe a little piece of it, just a piece of it. And so what happens, the Buddha describes, is that there's contact with something. Say we see a rose. We see the rose. And there's a feeling that's associated with that, a pleasant feeling in the case of the rose. We see the rose, it's beautiful, and it's pleasant. Then we like it, and we want it. So there's that craving piece. And from the craving comes this clinging, this movement to grasping onto something. And from that grasping then, there's a little bit of happiness, a little bit of, oh, whew, relief. And then after a while, that happiness fades. Either, you know, we take the flower, put it on our dashboard, it wilts, you know, we kind of forget about it. And there's just, you know, that happiness fades. And so we go off in search of the next, there's suffering, and we go off in search of the next hit of happiness. So our lives are kind of driven by these wanting these hits of pleasant and hits of happiness. There's one story I have about this. I was on a retreat, and one instruction that they said was that if you're experiencing aversion, there's something unpleasant in your experience. So see if you can find the unpleasantness. And I was doing walking meditation. On this retreat, walking meditation was a source of great aversion for me for some reason. When the people were walking near me, I kept being very averse to these people. And I was doing the walking meditation. Somebody came up next to me and started walking. And, oh, the aversion was so strong. It's like, I wanted to move. I wanted to leave to get rid of the aversion, but I decided to look at it. So, okay, what's unpleasant in this experience? And I actually couldn't find it at first. It took me a while to find the unpleasant. It's like, okay, well, the person isn't ugly or, you know, look deranged or anything. You know, it's a perfectly normal looking person. So, okay. I couldn't find anything in my senses that was unpleasant about this experience. So I thought, okay, well, it must be something in the mind. And I said, well, I'll look for my thoughts. What thoughts are happening? So I did some more walking. And this thought appeared. He's weird. Oh, that's a thought. And there wasn't much more information than that. But, you know, so, okay, I kept walking. And then a couple paths later, the thought appeared. It's freezing cold out, and he's in bare feet. And, you know, I just saw that my whole aversion was constructed to this belief, this idea that had been constructed out of thoughts. and a belief that this person was weird because they were in bare feet in the winter. And the whole thing just crumbled. So it's seeing the cause, the clinging to that belief, that clinging to that belief that he was weird was the suffering. And when I saw it, it just fell apart. So I wanted to emphasize this a little bit because the feeling is something I'm going to talk about some next week too, the feeling tone of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral. And it's a really crucial place to look at. But back to wanting for a minute. I think the genius of the Buddha, I really am so grateful to the Buddha for seeing this, is to discover that the wanting itself is the source of our suffering, rather, and it's the ending of the wanting that actually brings deeper happiness. Now, as I said before, the wanting itself is unpleasant. And when that unpleasant goes away, there's a happiness. And normally we think of ending that unpleasantness by getting something, but there's another way. There's actually another way. And one of the joys of meditation is to begin to learn to watch our desires themselves, to see the desire itself without acting on them. Now, it might seem kind of strange, but to actually enjoy watching desire. But what you begin to see is that the desire itself is impermanent. And that as you watch it, if you just hang out with it and don't act on it, the desire itself will actually disappear. And if you get to see it disappear, you'll actually experience a moment of happiness with that disappearance of that desire. It can feel like you're released from a vice grip. So we learn by watching our desires come and go that there's another way to end the suffering, not by having, but by letting them arise, stay for a while, and then disappear. So this leads into the action that the Buddha suggested for the cause of suffering, and that is abandoning the cause of suffering, letting it go. And there's two ways we can look at this. There's an active sense of letting go, where when a desire comes up, we can see, oh, that's not going to go anyplace good. You know, like, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be as rich as Bill Gates? That's not going to go anywhere. There's no way I'm going to be able to be as rich as Bill Gates. That's easy to let go of. It's probably a silly example. But there are some things where when we see the desire, it's just so obvious that it's not a good idea that we can pretty easily let go of it. But there's also another way of letting go, of following this action that the Buddha suggested. And that's not actually to be active about letting go, but to let go of acting on the desire and just watch, just observe the desire. And when we do that, we'll see that it's impermanent, we'll see that it passes. What essentially happens is that the desire lets go of itself because it's impermanent. It doesn't stay because the causes and conditions that led to the arising of that desire will change and it will disappear. In the suttas, there's very often the statement, the Buddha says, he says to one of his monks, can you tell me what I teach about the Four Noble Truths? And the monk will say, you teach, this is suffering, this is the cause of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And for a long time, I didn't really quite understand that. It just sounded to me like they were parroting it back to him, what he had said. But I think what he's saying, or what the Buddha is asking and seeing when the monk replies this, is that the monk understands the suffering in the present moment. It's an instruction. This is suffering, to pay attention, to know what's happening in the present moment. This, what I'm experiencing right now, is suffering, as you were saying. Yes, this is suffering. Same thing, if you see the wanting, this is wanting. This is the cause of suffering. It's kind of a framework for our experience as an experience arises in the present moment. What is it? Is it release? Is it happiness? Is it wanting, the cause of suffering? Is it suffering itself? So we can pay attention to the Four Noble Truths in the present moment. And suffering itself occurs in the present moment. It doesn't occur in the past. It doesn't occur in the future. If we're suffering over something that happened in the past, what's happening is that we're remembering it and we're suffering about it right now in the present moment, suffering about that thought in the present moment. Some years ago, I was in a play, and one night in a performance, I forgot a line, and I tried to cover for it by ad-libbing a few lines, but the people on stage with me didn't pick up on the fact that I was missing, and at some point I ran out of just stuff to say, and there was this huge, horrible pause, and, you know, I looked out at the audience, and it's like, you know, it's just so clear. Here I am. You know, it's like the illusion of a play broke down in that moment. It was very painful. And for many years after that, when something triggered that memory, I felt the pain of that all over again. It just, the embarrassment just flooded back into me. I was right there back on stage with the people in the audience looking at me, you know, silence in the auditorium. It was just, and on one retreat I had, this memory for some reason just came up over and over and over again, and I just kept feeling this horrible feeling over and over again. And it became so clear over time that I wasn't suffering in the past. You know, I was suffering now. It wasn't like that suffering of that embarrassment was with me all the time. It came up when that memory came up. And I was suffering now because I was reacting to that memory now. So that was a quite an interesting revelation. So not only does suffering occur in the present moment, but also the cause, the craving, the wanting occurs in the present moment. So even though some of the events in the past may have set up the conditions for suffering in the present, the actual direct cause of the suffering is because of a wanting right now in the present moment. Last week I told a story, I don't know, some of you might remember, a period in my practice where I was very angry. And I experienced one day I saw a thought arise. I had been looking at the anger for quite some time, and I saw a thought arise, and I saw in the seeing of that thought, I saw the tendency or the wanting almost to get onto that thought, to become angry. There was like a desire to become angry. But I noticed that desire, and I also had been sitting with this anger for long enough that I really knew it was suffering. I didn't want to go there. So having seen the wanting, I let go of that wanting, and the anger didn't arise. It was really quite a mind-blowing event to see that I had the choice of the wanting arose, and I could see I don't have to go there. I can let go of that. So that's where our choices are. It's right now. We can choose right now if we're aware, if we're awake, if we're mindful. So last week also I did a reflective meditation, and since I noticed that so many of you weren't here last week, I'll give the instructions for this reflective meditation again briefly. So what we'll do is we'll sit together for 5 minutes or so, and then this type of reflection isn't an active thinking, but I'll drop a word into your meditation after about 5 minutes or so, and just see what the response is in your body and mind to that word. Don't particularly think about it. Don't let the mind get caught in that reaction. But just keep coming back to the word and see what happens. And I'll give you a couple of words over the space of the meditation. So we'll just start with some silence. Wanting. Having. Wanting. Letting go. So I'd like to open it up for discussion again to see if there's any comments about the reflection or comments or questions about what I said.
dropped the words into the meditation, I immediately started thinking. And I started to wonder about, in Buddhist terms, what is the difference between healthy wanting and unhealthy wanting? Like, for example, you use the example of the rose. I was noticing those flowers up there. And I thought, I'd like to get those for my home. And but my reason for wanting them in my home is to make it more aesthetically beautiful. Okay? Is that an unhealthy thing in the Buddhist tradition? You know what I mean? I have a hard time seeing where... Yes, I do understand where that can cause suffering, because then next week I want more flowers. But isn't it healthy to want?
Yes, in fact, I meant to mention something about that. Thank you for reminding me. yes, not all desire is bad. It's that kind of urgent sense of wanting, that thirsty wanting, that is the problem, mostly. In fact, a form of desire is what spurs us on to practice. I mean, we would not be practicing were it not for desire, for wanting. We want to end suffering. It's a very healthy movement of the mind. I think you actually touched very closely on the difference between the wholesome and unwholesome wanting, and it has to do with the intention, the motivation behind the wanting. So you can look at that, the intention, and I'll actually talk about that a little bit in an exercise I'm going to give you. But in the example of the roses, now if your wanting led you to take these roses away from here, that might not be so wholesome, because it would be taking something that all of us... Now, if it spurred you to go out and buy roses for your own home, that might be a different form of the wanting. So you need to look at the motivation and also the consequences of... what might happen to other people if you take an action. Is there any more that I could think of a little bit more to say, but
well, I also started thinking in terms of my career. I'm always looking for more. Always. I reach a point where I'm happy for a while, and then I must do more. And that sometimes, I don't know if that's healthy or not. That's what was going through my mind when we were dropping the words in. I'm thinking now, is this healthy reaching forward or not? When does it become growth? As opposed to some desperate need to prove something. You know?
Right.
It's a very subtle question.
I think that the key is to hang out with the wanting, to let yourself be comfortable in that space of wanting. Because often we're not comfortable in that space of wanting. We have a kind of impatience about wanting that to end. And if we let ourselves hang out in that space of wanting, we'll begin to see the motivations that are underlying it. And we can sort those out, sort out the healthy ones from the unhealthy ones, and make a more informed decision, as opposed to being just driven by our desires. We see our desires more clearly, and we can act from a more conscious place. So if we can let ourselves just hang out there, I know it's a really uncomfortable place to hang out, but if we can just let ourselves hang out there and not expect it or have to have it go away, that's a really helpful. That's actually the exercise that I'm going to suggest. So, Mark.
Well, I noticed when you said the word wanting a couple of times that I had a real visceral sort of a reaction to it, and it was definitely unpleasant. It's kind of like the things seem to be more pleasant than that. And letting go actually seemed kind of neutral.
Thank you. Louis?
I noticed that with wanting, I felt kind of contrary, and I thought, oh, the sauce wants salt. You know, that was about, you know, it was kind of. When it came to having, I immediately started feeling contrary again. I thought of having, you know, cutting something in half.
Oh.
And then I realized I have an itchy eye. And the lower corner of the left eye was itchy. I was trying to think about exactly where that itch was on the corner of the eye. And then I thought, I remembered some advice once, and I thought, I wonder if it'll go away on an inhalation or an exhalation. And after a few, you know, it began to diminish almost immediately. Then when it came to letting go, I somehow felt that I was growing smaller, that I was shrinking, actually physically becoming smaller. And I thought that was interesting because that wasn't like, you know, I wasn't expecting anything, but I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting that. And it seemed almost as though there was less me there. And then I could see that made sense because that's a lot of letting go, is to have less me out there, and there's less holding on.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Louis.
Mm-hmm. I noticed around wanting, feeling very vulnerable. Just was a vulnerable state for the time I was able to hang out and being mindful of the feeling just when you said the word, and then I went on to start thinking about things that I want, and there was a whole story that went with that. But it was interesting to notice feeling vulnerable around wanting. And then having, first this sort of sense of pleasant fullness and solidity, and then not too long after that, burden. It's good this wasn't too long, just when you said letting go. I just thought, how do you know? You know, how do you know that your letting go is authentic? How do you know that it's not resignation or giving up or indifference or, you know, I guess, well, so you have to try it and see.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, actually, you know, I just spent the last week managing a Dzogchen retreat up at Spirit Rock, and that practice of letting go and resting in that letting go is very, very strong in that tradition. And that came to me too, is how do I know this is authentic, you know, release, you know, whatever. And what I began to see is that it doesn't really matter that what you experience when you try to let go is the direction to head. You know, it's the right direction. And as you continue with the practice, it will kind of refine itself and it will get more and more clear. It will be clear itself that the letting go is not delusion. Yeah, so that was a really nice thing to have realized, that just trust it, the trusting of it.
Oh, okay.
That's good. It's hard.
On what you just said about letting go, I've had the experience sometimes of being in a very unpleasant state where I really wanted to let go very badly, and it really turned into another kind of grasp, because I wanted to let go so bad that I was really suffering. So, I mean, it's a little tricky, you know.
Yeah. You try to let go, but you can't want to let go. Yes. Exactly. Thank you, Mark. So I'd like to suggest a couple of exercises again this week. I hope you'll kind of enjoy these exercises. So the first thing is what I said earlier, just to see if you can hang out with wanting, just to get familiar with it. I'm not suggesting that you try to, you know, not act on any of your desires here. I'm just suggesting you get familiar with what it feels like. And to maybe, if you can, take a moment before you act on your desire. Just hang out there for a moment, you know, 15 seconds, and see what's happening in that place. Just see what's happening in that wanting place. You may see some motivations, what the motivations are for that wanting. And that may give you a more informed place from which to move forward with an action out of that desire. So just see if you can observe wanting. And then once or twice, maybe, you know, even if you just do it once, it's great. Try to ride out a desire. You know, pick something really minimal, like, you know, desire for a between meal snack or, you know, chocolate ice cream or something. But just hang out with the, notice that the desire has come up and just hang out with it until it disappears. And maybe what you'll notice is that your mind, you know, trying to hang out with it for a while, that your mind has gone on to something else and that you don't actually see it disappear. You just notice that, oh, it's not here anymore. I'm on to something else now. But just try to ride it out and see if you can get to the place where you no longer want that thing that you thought you wanted. If you can actually see the desire disappear, just, you know, if you can hang out with the wanting long enough to actually see the wanting disappear, what does it feel like when the wanting disappears? So that's the second thing. And a good way, actually, to try this one is in meditation, if you do a daily meditation practice. And I tried this pretty early in my practice. It's an exercise suggested by Jack Kornfield in his book, A Path with a Heart. And I'll read it to you. I'll read it directly as he puts it, because it's very clear. In your daily meditation practice, make a resolve that for 1 week you will not get up until a strong impulse to do so arises 3 times. Sit as you usually would, being mindful of your breath, body, and mind. But do not set a fixed time for the end of your meditation. Instead, sit until a strong impulse tells you to get up. Notice its quality. It may arise from restlessness, from hunger, from knee pain, from thinking about how much you have to do, or the need to go to the bathroom. Softly name the energy that has arisen, and with it sense the impulse to move. Feel it carefully in your body, naming wanting to get up, wanting to get up, staying with it for as long as it lasts. This is rarely for more than a minute. Then, after this impulse has passed, notice what it feels like now, and if your meditation has deepened from sitting through the whole impulse process. Continue to sit until a second impulse to arise pulls you strongly. Notice the whole process in the same way as before. Finally, after a third time of carefully being with the whole impulse process, allow yourself to get up. The depth and attention and centeredness will gradually grow through this process. If you wish, you can extend your observation to other strong impulses, noting the whole process of wanting to move or scratch an itch. So I'd just like to suggest that. I tried this pretty early in my practice. I found early on, I didn't think I could sit for longer than 20 minutes. And, you know, I just, you know, sat for 20 minutes and got up. And I read this instruction and I tried it. And the first impulse to move happened after about 20 minutes. And I wrote it through. And after the third time, I got up and I looked at the clock and I realized I'd sat for 45 minutes. And I realized, oh, I can sit for 45 minutes. And from then on, I was sitting for 45 minutes. It had broken my assumption about how long I could sit by just doing this. I just, doing this exercise one time, it did that for me. So I really encourage you to try this and see what happens. And as I said, I'll just restate again, I'm definitely not suggesting that you stop acting on your desires, but just become familiar with what it feels like to want. So Thank you.